Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky. Good evening. There are two parts to every crime story: how they did it and why they got caught. This book is about the second part and how it changes the way we catch serial killers. No two stories about the capture of a serial killer are the same. Sometimes the killers make crucial mistakes. Other times investigators get lucky. And the process of profiling, hunting, and apprehending these predators has changed radically over time, particularly in the field of criminal forensics, which has exploded in the last 10 to 15 years. Laser ablation, video spectral analysis, cyber sleuthing, and even DNA-based genetic genealogy are now crucial tools in solving murders, including the recent capture of the so-called Golden State Killer. This book in the new Profiles in Crime series tells the story, history of forensics through the capture stories of some of the most notorious serial killers, going back almost a century. The killers include Rodney Alcala, a serial rapist and murderer sometimes called Dating Game Killer for his appearance on that TV show. No one knows the exact number of his victims. Takahiro Shirarishi, the suicide killer from Zama, Japan, who dismembered 9 victims and stored their bodies in his refrigerator. Aileen Wuornos, one of the rare female serial killers. She shot 7 men in Florida and was turned in by an accomplice. Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee cannibal, and Bobby Joe Long, both identified by survivors. Ted Bundy and David Berkowitz, Son of Sam, who both made mistakes. Ludwig Tesnau, who killed several children in Germany, was caught through new methods in forensic investigation that could distinguish human from animal blood. The book that we're featuring this evening is How to Catch a Killer: Hunting and Capturing the World's Most Notorious Serial Killers, with my special guest, journalist and author and professor, Catherine Ramslin. Welcome back to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Catherine Ramslin.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's always fun to talk with you, and I appreciate being on the show again.
Thank you very much. You were always one of my favorite authors, the incredible amount of true crime classic books that you've written, over 60 books. Let's get right to this book, How to Catch a Killer, Hunting and Capturing the World's Most Notorious Serial Killers. In your acknowledgments, you list several FBI profilers. Give us a few names of some of these profilers and what they gave you access to.
Well, most of them were retired. I worked with them either in research projects or on their own books. I started working with John Douglas on a book called The Cases That Haunt Us. I did the research for most of the cases then, and then we got together. He talked it through. Mark Olshaker was his co-writer in that book. So
right.
I worked on that. I worked with Mark Safrick on a book about spree killers, where we classified spree killers from countries all over the world. We had probably the most cases of any database on that. And that book came out in November. I worked with Greg McCrary on a book of his cases. I was about to work with Bob Ressler when he got sick, and then unfortunately he passed away. So I didn't get to do work with him, but I interviewed him. I interviewed Hazelwood, on and on. So sometimes I would consult on cases if they just wanted to pass things by me from the kind of research I've been doing. So that's really it, mostly researching cases for them or co-writing books with them.
You write that you analyzed 300 cases for identification and arrest details and identified more than a dozen distinct variables that played a key role in their capture. And that's what this book is, obviously. And then we talk about the, and you write about in your book, it's part one is forensic innovation, and you list the Mad Carpenter, the Footpad Killer, the Clean Cut Killer, the Vienna Courier, BTK, and the Golden State Killer in that first part. In part two, it's police procedure, and you list the Cannibal Killer, the Killer Clown, the Dating Game Killer, the Slave Master, the ABC Killer, the Hanging Pro, the Grudge Collector, the Choke and Stroke Killer. And you have part three, Mistakes and Calculations, the Chicago Scammer, the Moors Murderers, the Cross Country Chameleon, the Classified Ad Rapist, the Bundy Wannabe, the Chessboard Killer, the Grinder Killer. And part four is Witness Reports, the Soap Maker of Corrigio, Son of Sam, the Night Stalker, the Man-Eater, Aileen Wuornos, the Milwaukee Monster, and the Letum of Vigitas. Part five, you title it Self-Surrender, the Candyman's Apprentice, the Co-Ed Killer, and the Angel of Death, and then your brief summary. Let's go to the Footpad Killer and what it demonstrates. Let's take us to November 21st, 1983, in Leicestershire County, England, and Linda Mann, who's 15 years old and has a friend named Karen. Can you tell us a little bit about the Footpad Killer?
Okay, well, first let me just address the idea of a serial killer. Definition has evolved. It used to be, from the FBI at least, it used to be that a person had to have murdered at least three people on three separate occasions in three locations. That is no longer in use, although there are a lot of people who still believe that that's the definition. In fact, it now is simply two victims in two distinctly different incidents could still be the same location. But that's why this case qualifies as serial murder. There were two victims, two young girls taking what they call a footpad or a footpath to these small British villages, English villages. And they were 3 years apart, but the investigators thought it was probably the same person who had killed both of them, although they couldn't be certain of that. And around the same time, and this is in the forensic innovation section, so around the same time, Sir Alec Jeffries was doing work on DNA analysis, and he had done some paternity testing for people who were, wanting to prove their parentage.
Right.
And he had made a speech, and the chief of the investigation of the footpad murders heard about it, read about it in the newspaper, and he contacted Jeffries and asked, would you be interested in doing this on some murder cases? And Jeffers had not thought about that, but he was eager to test his procedure on those cases. Now, they had a suspect in custody who had confessed to one of the crimes, but not the other, submitted his samples to Jeffries, and Jeffries came back and said, well, the good news is that it is the same guy for both. The bad news is it's not the guy who confessed. It actually became the first DNA exoneration in history. It was the first DNA dragnet because they began taking blood samples from all the men of a certain age, men and boys of a certain age, from the villages and a few nearby areas, looking for the person. And this is obviously a very expensive procedure at that time. But it turned out that it was a guy, Colin Pitchfork, who had paid someone else to take the test for him, but that person started talking to other people at a a gathering of pubs and was overheard. Police ended up with the information, and they brought Colin Pitchfork in, and it turned out he was the guy. So it changed investigation forever around the world pretty quickly, because DNA was an amazing tool. It didn't go uncontested, of course.
Right.
You know, defense attorneys immediately found all kinds of issues with, you know, the collection of it at crime scenes and some of the claims being made, some of the statistical analyses. And they were right, but it still is the most tested, the most rigorous tool that we currently have for crime investigation if DNA is left at a scene. Certainly not all crimes will have DNA. So that's a common misperception of the public, because they just think, oh, why don't you just use DNA on everything? Because, you know, we don't have it. So, but it did change everything. And so that's obviously a case I would have wanted in the forensic innovation section. And another one in there, you know, proceeds with the forensic genealogy, you know, also
right.
a DNA type of testing, because the Golden State Killer, which, you know, has gained a lot of press, was identified this way. So that's a new innovation that grew out of the kinds of things they've done with DNA over the years. They keep perfecting it. They keep changing some of the ways they approach it so that they can get increasingly smaller samples. So now we have touch DNA. So back in the Pittsburgh days, all they had was you had to have a sample around the size of a nickel. But now, obviously, you know, we're much more sophisticated. But at the same time, the potential for corruption of samples is high, much higher than it used to be. Because if you have touch DNA, you know, there's so many people who could potentially handle a sample or could potentially have touched the same area where a killer or a rapist has touched. So there still are complications. It's not a, you know, 100% sure-proof method, but it's certainly better than anything else we had.
Yeah, certainly. In your second part with police procedure, you have the cannibal killer and the killer clown, which is John Wayne Gacy, of course, and Rodney O'Kayla, the dating game killer, and the slave master, Robinson. People are familiar with some of those stories, but another one that's a little bit less familiar for everyone, I think, is the ABC killer. Tell us a little bit about Pretoria, Johannesburg, in July and October 1994, and what you've learned from this story, what this story of the ABC killer demonstrates.
Yeah, the ABC killer, that was kind of a real shocking one in terms of the way the bodies were found, because, you know, we typically think about serial killers having, you know, sort of dumping bodies or leaving them, you know, in a house or something like that. But in South Africa, these bodies were all, you know, lots of bodies were dumped in the same place, but it was in three different areas. The innovation there was really, or the police procedure there was really the use of behavioral profiling analysis to make these linkages. It turns out that they had really a lot of serial killers around this particular time. So they had several suspects. And one was a really good one who ended up not being the guy, but he was, you know, logic would say, and even his own confession would say that he was the person, but he wasn't. It turned out
right.
to be a man named Moses Sithole, who really had perfected this way of, I mean, he knew that there were a lot of young women who were looking for work because it was a time of social unrest and high unemployment and, you know, a lot of needs. So he presented himself as a man who was able to get them jobs. I mean, he dressed in a suit. He was very, you know, not what you ordinarily think of these serial killers. He presented himself in a way that not only did he seem to these women to be a source of potential future employment, but even romance, because he was a good-looking guy. And so they very easily went with him, and he would say things like, I want to take you out, show you where I'm going to be building a big factory. So they would go with him walking in isolated places where then that was his killing ground. He could easily kill them and dump the body right there with all the other bodies. So it's kind of, I mean, it's surprising that it's not a more well-known case, I think, because the number of bodies in each of these areas, and they were pretty accessible. They weren't that isolated. So it shows you also, at a time of social unrest, how the police weren't really even investigating many of these women disappearing. And it really took a very focused, concentrated task force to do this. They brought in Robert Ressler from the FBI, who he was sort of mentoring a young woman who was getting her PhD, I think, in forensic psychology, and she had already been doing some profiling. So she asked him to bring him in because this is really a massive undertaking. So he came in, he observed each of the areas where they had found these victims. They're called the ABC killings, even though it's not that clear whether it actually was A, B, and C, but it was for the names of the towns where the dump sites were near. And so he went in and he helped her make this profile, and turned out to be Moses Sithole. So I just think, I've always thought that was an interesting case. We kind of have this issue with the media of not covering crimes that are black serial killers or Hispanic serial killers, minorities. We tend not to put as much emphasis on those, and even on females, as we do on white males, and in particular in America. So I hear things like, there just aren't as many serial killers anymore. But in fact, they're just not being covered by the media. We certainly have them, and they're also coming up in many other countries that didn't used to have these kinds of organized, focused investigations. And they didn't record people as serial killers, but now that's changing. So it's very difficult to really say from one decade to another, from one country to another, who has the most or when we're the most, also in part because of the evolving definition of a serial killer. But we certainly see them, and especially as we get more sophisticated technology, more sophisticated recording of crimes and linking them to offenders, we're certainly seeing a lot more of that. But we are definitely seeing them among minorities as well. And in this case, I think because Moses Sithole was black, it just didn't make the news the way I think, internationally, the way I think it probably should have.
And it was, you also include some horrifying details of murder once apartheid ends in Africa. You have the Cape Town Strangler tortured and killed at least 20 sex workers, the Donnybrook serial killer, Cristobal Zokode, 18, and attempted 11 more. And you had numerous other, the Phoenix Strangler, Station Strangler. You say by 2004, 50 South African serial killers in 20 years, an increase of 900% annually between 1990 and 1996.
Yeah, I wanted to use the Sithole case to bring attention to that there were so many, and a lot of it was due to the social conditions at the time. I'm not the analyst on that. I'm not really a sociologist, but people who have looked at that have seen the rise in violence, and especially of the serial nature, to be very directly associated with the changeover after apartheid, the lack of policing, the lack of accountability among many of these killers. It's astonishing. I think Moses Sithole, is an interesting one, even among all those, for, you know, the ways he operated. But I think I also wanted to bring attention to, you know, look at this time period. It's really astonishing how many serial murderers were operating in this area at this time, and often, you know, not apprehended for a while because there just wasn't a policing, you know, support system as there, you know, there eventually was. But I wanted him to be situated in a sociological period that showed us not just the developmental trajectory of a serial killer, but also the social components of it. I think he's perfectly situated to demonstrate that. And I really think all serial killers have something of that in the way they develop. I mean, I think you can kind of see that. I have the choke and stroke killer, you know,
right,
the guy who's claiming over 100, you know, and he'll talk about how he looked around for marginalized victims that he knew police wouldn't investigate very
right.
much. And, you know, and then he moved around from place to place very easily, escaping because he knew the investigation wouldn't go on for very long. The resources just wouldn't be put into something like, you know, black female sex workers in,
sure,
you know, some small town in Florida or Louisiana. So he tapped into conditions that he thought would support his ability to succeed. And even though we haven't yet, you know, corroborated all the claims he's making, he certainly got away with a lot of murders because he looked at what was in his best interest. So that's also very interesting. I do want the book, even though it's 30 distinctly different cases, I do want the book to show the larger sociological impacts. Sometimes even politics are involved. Sometimes it's about the nature of journalism. For example, the Jack Unterweger case in Austria, we had
right.
a group of elite journalists who, you know, were reading the works. He already was in prison for a murder.
Yeah.
And life for life. But they were reading things that he was writing. Personally, I didn't think they were that good. I translated some of them and thought it's just a whiny psychopath, basically. But they thought
yeah.
he was, you know, that art had cured him. And they
That's
managed
right.
to use political persuasion to get him sprung, whereupon he immediately began to murder in three different countries, including the United States, and took advantage of the fact that people thought, wow, you know, he's a journalist. You know, and actually he was hired to cover these crimes because
Incredible.
Not only was he a writer, but he was a murderer. Who better to cover these murders than someone like him? So he was given an assignment, for example, to come to Los Angeles. And he went to the police department and said, you know, I'm writing about sex workers here in Los Angeles. Where would I go? And they took him down and showed him because the idea was a journalist who's doing this. It's certainly not a serial killer. Well, they were wrong. The Austrian literati were wrong. Art does not cure a psychopath. And as a result, you know, 10 more women were dead. So yeah, I'm skipping around a lot because I know, but there are themes that link all these cases in terms of how many of these predators exploited conditions to operate as successfully as they could.
This case also really demonstrates also the so-called rehabilitation of murderers as well. And you say it couldn't be rehabilitated through art, but there's been other people rehabilitated through other things where they impressed people and seemed to overlook the murders that they were in prison for. It's a profound example.
Yeah, and I think psychopaths are so good, especially very predatory ones. Now, not all psychopaths are serial killers or murderers or even criminals. the majority are not. But those that are predatory, they develop what is called context cueing or cognitive cueing, where they look specifically for those aspects of other people that they can exploit, and they know how to do it. The most successful ones, you know, obviously Ted Bundy and John Wayne Gacy are among those. They know how to present themselves to allay suspicion, to make it seem as if they, you know, are, like, I guess Bundy's a good example, bright, young, good-looking law student, psychology major. How could that be a serial killer? Well, they can be, and I think we've developed a number of strange myths about serial killers that actually assist them in getting away with what they do. For example, Dennis Rader, one of the cases where police were actually out looking for a missing woman that he had just murdered and dumped. He had used an overnight camping, Boy Scout camping thing where he was a volunteer. He had used that to his advantage by, when he encountered the police officer who was looking for, you know, the guy, he talked a lot about the fact that, oh, you know, I was just at this Boy Scout camp out, and you know, because he knew that there's no way they're going to suspect him or look in his car, which would have been incriminating, because he's a Boy Scout volunteer. But you know what? He's not the only Boy Scout volunteer that we've had who ended up actually being a predator and a killer. So one of the reasons I actually wrote the book on Dennis Rader with him was to offer it as a cautionary tale for police to not buy into some of these myths, because killers who are very good at this use the myths to their advantage. And had that officer did his job that he was supposed to do, regardless of, you know, the whole Boy Scout persona, he would have found things that day. And he didn't, because he accepted. You know, I had another one. He's not in the book. But he, this was in France in the late 19th century. He convinced, he was, and had been in the army, and so he always wore his regalia from the military. So when police stopped him, often they also had army background too. So he exploited that to talk about, you know, our comradeship. You know, obviously I can't be a good killer you're looking for because we both served in the military. And they bought it and let him go. So that's often how predators operate, is they look specifically for things they can exploit that are based in these notions of what a serial killer is and isn't. But we have to be aware that we can always be surprised, because we will find serial killers in all walks of life, in, you know, male and female. So that's one of the things about this book, is it really shows they really come from a lot of different backgrounds, and we need to be more alert to how predators operate.
Speaking of that, you have a particularly interesting story that not so familiar to people, I think, and it's called The Hanging Pro, and about group suicide. And you also discuss the cultural context where this could even occur, which is very, very interesting in Japan as well. So can you tell us about The Hanging Pro?
Yeah, I stumbled across that because I also do suicidology. That's one of the things I teach. And suicidology is a particular aspect of forensic psychology that even a lot of forensic psychologists have never heard of it as a discipline, but it is really the focused study of suicide methods, motive. And through that, I found out about not just one guy, two different guys.
Yeah.
Within this, in Japan, there's kind of a suicide culture. It's romanticized. There's a forest where called the Hanging Forest. You know, it has other names too, but it's like a suicide shrine. Around the world, we have these places that people gravitate to commit suicide, like volcanoes, tall buildings, bridges, things like that. But there's the Hanging Forest is one of them. And so there's this odd romanticism among young people, some young people in Japan for suicide, and there were online groups offering support. So talk about clever. What a clever way to find victims.
Exactly.
Is to pretend that you are going to, you know, help them and even kill yourself with them so they won't be alone, which is what some of them would say they were looking for. So the potential victims would post on these suicide chats and websites, I'm looking for someone to, you know, go into a suicide pact with me or to help me through this. To be fair, also, Japan has set up counselors for this to go through these sites and try to talk these people out of it. So it's not like there's just no regulation at all. But, you know, if someone intends on suicide for whatever reason, we'll find ways typically to do it.
Sure.
So both of these guys, but the one I particularly focus on was Shirashi, would present themselves as, you know, I'll help you. Rashi would, you know, he's kind of this, unprepossessing kind of guy who didn't seem at all threatening. And he would, you know, talk about, oh, yeah, I completely understand what you're going through and what you want to do. And, you know, I'm willing to help you. And so he would have them come to his house and then kill them there. But he didn't, and it was like a small one-room apartment. It was, he really didn't think this through very well. So he had no way to really dispose of the bodies, and so he would dismember them. He kept some of them in coolers or his refrigerator or something like that. And they were kind of piling up, and so he'd turn on, you know, fans, whatnot, and the neighbors began to notice the, like, oh my God, what's going on in that place? The smells were horrible as the body parts began to decompose. And also, he wasn't very careful about it, but he was doing it. At one point, a friend of one of the victims actually accompanied her and was, you know, didn't want her to die, and he was kind of suspicious of this whole setup. So, you know, when she disappeared, he obviously had some inkling of where she might have disappeared to. And so that solved the case, essentially. But eventually, you know, the police would have come just because of what a nuisance this place was. The smell was horrifying. And this is a case in which I think the guy actually just wanted it to be over because he really hadn't thought it through. And although he was getting sort of a sexual thrill out of his ability to bring these women under his control, really, overall, it just couldn't keep going this way. He also himself had said to, I think, his father that he wanted to commit suicide. So I think he already had that kind of sensibility and was able then to talk to these young women about, you know, how he had been feeling. So he exploited that, and yeah, I think that's in my opinion, one of the most unique cases in the book of the MO of a serial killer, the way he approached them.
Yes, certainly. Certainly. I know we're still in police procedure, but can you tell us about the choke and stroke killer? Again, you just mentioned it briefly, but what, this is a fascinating story, and what unique lesson does it have for, I guess, police and forensic investigators?
I gotta actually look up his name. Get me, hang on here.
Sam Little.
Sam Little. I knew it was Sam. I can't remember the last name. Sam Little. That one has been in the news over the past year, because of the way, not just the multiple victims he claims, but the way he was persuaded to start talking was kind of interesting. It was a Texas Ranger. And it was had so many parallels to another Texas story, Henry Lee Lucas,
right,
who had claimed over 360. I think he even at one point even got up to 500, which was absurd.
Yeah.
And it turned out with Henry Lee Lucas that after these Texas lawmen had gotten all these confessions and closed cases in 19 states, and Lucas said, well, never, Josh, I didn't kill all those people. And he described how he had manipulated the officers' desire to close their cases by getting them to tell him a lot of details so that he would just spin it back to them. He drew a lot of pictures of these victims. He was allowed to look at all kinds of newspaper reports. And it turned out to be a major scam and a big disappointment, as well as a huge embarrassment to Texas law enforcement, because in the end, he was only convicted of one murder, and even that one, it turns out, was very unlikely to have been a victim of his. He probably, you know, killed, you know, a dozen, maybe more, but certainly not anywhere near the 300 plus that he claimed. So I thought the Sam Little case was very interesting because, again, it's a Texas Ranger who begins to approach him. The Ranger heard about this case. I think he was at a conference where one of the BICAPs, the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, one of the BICAP technicians had been talking about the potential that they might have a guy who's committed a number of cases which are currently unsolved in various states. And he had been caught and was being processed in California. So the Ranger decided, he had some of these cases, he decided to go talk to Sam Little. And Little was saying, you know, he was innocent of even the ones that he was getting convicted of. He was completely innocent.
Right.
You know, they were wrong. He was being very stubborn about giving up any of the details. But this Ranger was, you know, had the right approach. He flattered him. He talked about, you know, his artwork, et cetera. And little by little, he won him over, and Little began to make these drawings. Again, very much like Henry Lee Lucas. So, you know,
yeah,
that's a lot of red flags there. You know, another case of a guy confessing to, you know, dozens and dozens of murders and drawing these pictures of victims. Some of the ones he confessed to just couldn't be corroborated. There were no reports. They were from years ago. Very little was done to do the investigations. And that became, again, a big issue with the police maybe just not doing their jobs because they were sex workers, you know, black sex workers, drug addicts, things like that, that sometimes just don't get the resources devoted to them because they're high-risk victims. You know, they
sure
put themselves out into a space where a killer could come along very easily and, you know, could just be a stranger, a transient, you know, hitchhike or whatever. So it's very hard to really follow through on some of these cases. So that's for the cops to work out, not me. However, Sam Little, who had been a boxer, he had these huge hands, and he would entice these women, tell them they're beautiful, make them feel good, and, you know, really put them off their guard, and then take one of his fists and just slam it into them and either knock them out or even kill them, and then choke them. He's called the choke and stroke killer because he could actually choke them with one hand while he's masturbating with another, because he had these massive hands. and he needed, he had a particular, what we call a paraphilia or a sexual deviance. He needed that kind of, his hands around their neck to be aroused. And this was traced back to childhood, where he would see a, you know, a woman's neck, and that aroused him. So he had that fetish for a particular body part, and that's what he would do, he claims to do. Again, we haven't corroborated all of the incidents that he has discussed. And he's old, and he's ill. I'm not even sure he remembers all the details, but he has made quite a few drawings. I've kind of lost track of how many, but he's made quite a few drawings of the women he claims that were his victims. He traveled around the country, very transient, so that also made it difficult for police. There have been a few in Ohio, which is where he lived for a while. There have been a few cases in Ohio now attributed to him as well. But the investigation in that case continues. So the point at which my book stops, and I think I stopped writing and editing it around November last year. The point at which my book stops, obviously, that's as far as I go with that case, but I think anyone can look it up, the Sam Little case, and find out what more is being done, because the FBI, the BICAP personnel are really trying to piece this all together, and I'm sure more has been done even since November of last year that is not documented in my book, but it's he's a black serial killer, so unusual, and his approach to victims was very savvy for a guy with little education. So he brings up this notion that I've been asked about and I actually teach about, which is criminal intelligence versus the typical type of IQ that you would consider with normal IQ instruments like the Wechsler intelligence test that most people use these days. Criminal street smarts is what it often is called. But there, I actually think we should have an instrument called the CIQ, which would be sick. The CIQ would be criminal intelligence, because I think we'll see things like Gary Ridgway, for example, the Green River killer, not very bright on IQ tests, actually quite below average, but wow, smart, very smart about his crime. And I think Stan Little is similar in that he really had a way of finding victims who were going to respond to him, knew how to get them to respond, and kill them. Now, I think he made a couple of statements about victims, like they now, and I was really doing them a mercy, you know, that kind of idea. But there was one woman who I think I mentioned who had just gotten off a bus, and he met her at a bus station, and she just gotten a divorce and was feeling actually very good about starting her life over, and he killed her. So some of the things he had to say, like any of these predators, is mixed with lies and self-serving statements. I mean, we can talk a lot about Dennis Rader in that respect, because I spent 5 years working with him on his autobiography, and, you know, a lot of what he had to say was just self-serving. I think we have to expect that, because primarily they're narcissists who are always looking to their own advantage, who often will blame the victims for coming into their web. And, you know, most of them are just, in my opinion, losers who were smart enough to figure out how to do it and get away with it for often long periods of time.
And they also blame, it seems, an entity for their crimes, for the serial murder, that they were, it was somehow out of their control.
Yeah, some do. I mean, they don't all do that. Of this idea that an entity took them over. I think Kemper called it his little dapple. Some have referred to like a red out, where it's almost like a blackout, where they lose any sense of what's going on when they're actually murdering people. Rader, for a very short period of time, talked about being demon-possessed. But that was really the influence of the minister who came to visit him after his arrest. And he thought, well, that sounds as good as anything else. I'll use that for, a while. But he quickly dropped that when I came into the picture, because I don't buy that. I think Son of Sam also did the whole demon-possessed dog thing, but again, he dropped that when the profilers, Wrestler and Douglas, went in to see him. They were like, yeah, we don't buy that. And he goes, okay, and just start talking to them normally. But I think it's always easier sometimes for them, once they're caught, to say there was some other force. Bundy said it. Did Gacy say it? I don't remember if Gacy actually took that term, but it's a popular thing for these killers to just say, I lost control. I don't know what took over me. It was Gacy had the altered personality. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
John Hanley or whatever his name was, Gacy had the altered personality. So, there's always a way to sidestep this. I think Danny Rawlings talked about Gemini from The Exorcist 3. There's always ways to sidestep responsibility and throw blame on some supernatural force or alter personality or, something came over me, some dissociative state came over me. And I have no doubt, frankly, that it is a dissociative state, but that doesn't make it in any way psychotic or supernatural. All of us who daydream know what it is to be in a dissociated state. Because that's what daydreaming is. Our consciousness allows us to do that. They take it further and really lose themselves, submerge themselves in this completely eroticized sense of dominating and taking the life from another human being. And even those for whom the act of murder isn't the erotic thing, like maybe like Todd Kohlhepp, let's say, who murdered people because he was just an angry guy. He just was angry. But he also got an erotic thrill from the idea that he could do this and get away with it. So sometimes it's the actual murder, like the choke and stroke killer, that's the erotic part. Sometimes it's the dominating. Sometimes it's torturing them. Sometimes it's about sexual assault and rape, and then the murder is just to eliminate witnesses. I think that was probably the case with Gacy, at least for some of them. So, but there's always some kind of erotic component, and it's very easy to take this step to say, I was completely out of myself. It was a dissociated state because they're so fully engulfed in this experience.
What about the Night Stalker? Just talking about, using examples of saying someone's out of control, it was out of their control. His idea that he was doing this for Satan, what did you get from the Night Stalker's position?
I think Ramirez found a hook on which to hang what he was doing, and Satan was it, in part because he was reading the newspapers, and that's what they were talking about. He was also, and again, we're back to sociocultural factors. The 1980s was a time of high occultic activity and blame. And so we had a lot of the child care centers with the so-called satanic workers with this huge network all over the country, which never turned out to be anything. I mean, it was fully investigated. Mostly that was just a lot of superstition. But there were a number during the 1980s, and he's mid-1980s, there were a number of occultic-oriented types of crimes. So the newspapers would pick up on, anything that seemed to be occultic. And so I think he sort of played with that. I think it was fun for him. There certainly were aspects of his development that I think primed him for some kind of religious worship, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And he had experienced, I think it was a cousin, murdering a woman right in front of him. He certainly had some traumatic aspects of his development. But I think the whole satanic aspect that he continued through his life. I mean, he had that, if you wrote to him in prison, you know, he made you say you would be part of this whole satanic thing. At least some people who wrote to him were ordered to do that. But I think it was more something he adopted than something that actually motivated him. So he would leave the satanic symbols, you know, in victims' homes. I think one was even drawn on a victim. But that just gave him a sense of identity. I think he started killing simply, and we don't even know all of his victims. I think there were a few early on that he suspected of. I think one was a child. So it could just be he was this guy who just started killing people and then adopted the whole persona, because he really liked the Night Stalker image of him creeping into houses, and he liked the idea he was scaring people like that. But how much of that was really satanic worship, I don't know. I think that's Sona than a real motivator.
Yeah. When you talk about part three, mistakes and calculations, you have some, of course, once again, infamous killers like H.H. Holmes and Ian Brady and Myra Hindley and the Moores murders and the cross-country chameleon Ted Bundy. When we talk about the Bundy wannabe, Israel Keyes, what was the profound mistake or miscalculation that he made?
Well, Israel Keyes is actually one of, I mean, I hate saying favorite murders because it sounds like you're having fun with it, but I just found him extremely fascinating because there's no particular reason why he just started killing. But he did know as a child, now he was raised in an odd circumstance. He was homeschooled in this kind of cultish religion with some white supremacy associations. So he starts out that way. But he knew pretty early when he started talking about cruelty to animals and people backed away from him, but this is something he had to keep hidden. When he was actually arrested, he said he had been two different people for 12 years. So maybe that's the span of his killing, or who knows. We don't know because he committed suicide. So I guess I should have said spoiler alert, but at any rate, he was interesting in that he had studied other serial killers, but in particular had a thing for Ted Bundy, because Bundy was a cross-country killer, very mobile. And he thought Bundy had made some very clear errors in gassing up and with credit cards, where he left a trail that helped police to hone in on him as a good suspect in some of the killings in Colorado and Utah.
Right.
So Keyes thought Bundy had made some errors, and he wanted to be like Bundy, but without those mistakes. So he had no victim type. And actually, Bundy claims he didn't either. He was just always looking for women, college-age type of women, because he liked the feeling of domination. But he also took victims of opportunity that weren't in any way. It wasn't girls with long, dark hair parted in the middle. If you look at his entire array, short hair, hair on the side, blonde, you know, curly. Even he said, I don't know what people are talking about with that. But anyway, that's Bundy. So back to Israel Keyes. He had no victim type. What he wanted to do was he would fly someplace, often rob a bank, buy some items that he put into these buckets, like Home Depot buckets, that could be sealed and buried. And inside these kits were things he would use later to kill and, you know, dispose of a victim in some way. So he had a gun, he had, rope or a shovel, a collapsible shovel, things that he knew that he would need. And then he'd go away and not come back for a while. So whatever security videos at the store where he bought the items or at the bank, all of that would no longer be useful.
Right.
And then he, and I'm just telling you what he said he did. We don't know that any of this ever actually happened. So he said that he would then wait for he'd go to make a cemetery or a hiking trail or some isolated place, and he'd grab the first person who came along, kill them, bury them, and move on. And that way he would never be traced or associated with that victim. But the weird thing is, the three that we actually know about, one was a couple in Burlington, Vermont, which he didn't realize was Ted Bundy's birthplace. So much for being, a fanboy of Ted Bundy.
Yeah, yeah.
He actually was surprised when he found that out. Wow. Anyway, he killed a couple in Burlington only because he had missed doing his typical thing because it was raining, no one was out, and he just decided he wanted to kill somebody. So he killed this couple and then stupidly left the newspaper items on his laptop, which he had made a rule against ever doing, but he did it. And then he went back to Alaska where he lived. He had a girlfriend and a daughter. And he kidnapped a young barista, Samantha Koenig, out of one of these late-night coffee stands.
Right.
And did this very elaborate thing where he took her bank card and, again, breaking his own rules, he took her bank card, he raped and killed her, left her body in a shed on his girlfriend's property, weirdly, went on a cruise with his daughter for 10 days, came back, posed Samantha's body with a newspaper to make it look as if she were still alive. He taped her eyes open and all that. And then he began to collect money out of her bank account. But he, at that point, had flown to Arizona, took money out of a bank there at an ATM. He needed a rental car. So that's what he would do. He'd rent these cars with cash. So, again, he can't be traced and false names and whatnot. But he made a mistake. The ATM had caught a part of the rental car so they could figure out what kind of car it was and what color. Now, the police didn't know he was switching out rental cars, but when he did do that, he got the same color again. So even though he could have foiled the police by getting a different kind of car, he didn't do that. He ended up, I guess it was Texas, he went to a wedding, his sister's wedding, and the Texas, law enforcement was alerted to the kind of car to be looking for. They found it. They were able to pull him over. Again, broke several rules of his, to have his gun ready to hand so he could kill himself if he were ever arrested, but the gun was out of his reach. So
right.
He also had Samantha Koenig's bank card, license, a few other things that linked him to the Alaska crime. He had the Burlington murders on his computer. So all of these so-called mistakes that he claimed Ted Bundy made, clearly Bundy was far superior to Israel Keyes in getting away with things. Now, a lot of people think, he then bantered with his interrogators to, he wanted to make a deal, kill me within, have me executed within a year, don't let this leak out to the press because I don't want my daughter to hear about it, and I will give you 8 more. So instead of saying, okay, just lying, and I think in part that was because the DA took over and he wasn't really allowed to offer a deal like that. So unfortunately, they probably could have gotten, if there are 8 victims, they probably could have gotten them and then told them, oops, sorry, we can't do that. But you know, they dickered around with him. He wasn't giving up any more details. And finally, he decided just to kill himself. So we have these potential 8 victims out there. But I kind of wonder if there are 8. There might be a few more. But he did such a bad job with the final 3. I really wonder that he was so good at the earlier ones.
Jeez.
I just don't know. He could have easily been making stuff up. Who knows? Because they do. A lot of serial killers will talk to many more murders than they've actually done. I have no idea. We don't know. And I think that so far there's been only one other murder potentially linked to him that looks pretty good, but not provable. So why do I like him? I like him because what a unique idea, even though he didn't pull it off very well. What a unique idea to just have no association with a victim, no victim type, no real clear motive that we know of. And just traveling, using cash, robbing banks, doing all these things to make sure there was no trail. It was very, very clever and unique. You know, in serial killer lore, this is a very unique approach.
Right. When you get to part 4 of your book, Witness Reports, you have Son of Sam, the Night Stalker was mentioned, the Man-Eater, Aileen Wuornos, and the Milwaukee Monster, obviously Jeffrey Dahmer. But you have a soap maker of Correggio, and you have another one I'm going to mangle in my pronunciation, La Matajavichitas. Can you tell us about the soap maker of Correggio, though, and what was about the witness reports that doomed this killer?
He's another really unique one. So both of the ones you just mentioned were women. And one was from Mexico and the other's from Italy.
Right.
The soap maker, one of the most unique motivators of all time. And her ability to kill and dismember people was really astonishing. I found her when I went into a little crime museum in Rome. And I don't know that it's still open. Someone told me it closed. But at the time, they had all these amazing displays of Italian crimes. And there was her, you know, big kettle where she had cooked flesh, or you know, all these crime tools she had used was this big display, and I had not heard of her before. So I just thought, wow, this is astonishing. When I looked at her case, she was this woman in Italy who, you know, got her mother had not wanted her, had a terrible relationship with her mother, and she vowed she would never be like that. She got married. She had a lot of children, but a fortune teller told her that they all would die before her, which horrified her. And as a matter of fact, they began to die one after another. And she just thought she's got to figure out some way to appease the supernatural forces that for some reason had it in for her. And when her son, her oldest son, said he was going to go out and join Mussolini's army, she thought, oh my God, that's high risk. There's no way he's going to survive that. I have to do something. So she began to, and she was a she would make these tea cakes and soaps and candles to sell out of her shop. So that was how she helped to support herself. She got this plan that she could buy her son's life by sacrificing another one. So she created this. She knew of a woman who I think it was a matchmaker thing. Another one was getting her employment in another town. I think this was the one for employment. And these women were friends. But she invited them to her house on 3 different occasions, 3 different people. She invited them to her house to, you know, help them pack up, get ready. She said, write letters to everybody that you know. Tell them you found a job or you found a romance in some other city and that you're not coming back. You're happy. Write all these letters. I'll mail them for you.
Yeah.
Anytime someone says that to you, that's a red flag.
Sure.
John Robinson did the same thing, by the way. write all these letters, I'll mail them for you. And then she would feed them drugs, wine or tea or something. They'd pass out, she'd kill them, drag them in kitchen, take off all the limbs, dismember them, behead them, take all the flesh off. She drained the blood onto pans to bake into a hard substance that she could grind down into flour that she then used to make these tea cakes. The flesh she boiled down with all the stuff she'd used for her soaps and made them into soaps and candles. But she'd send these tea cakes to her son to eat, and then she ate some, and she also sold some to people. And even when the police came looking for these missing women, she gave them the tea cakes.
Oh,
jeez. So finally, a witness says, on the third victim, I saw her go in to Leonardo. It's Leonardo Cianci, if I didn't say her name. I saw her go into Leonardo's house and not come out. And now she's missing. So the police investigated, and Leonardo pretty much freely confessed because she thought she was doing the right thing by her son. So she was fully justified in doing these things. And each time she killed, it was because she thought the supernatural forces needed yet another life to preserve her sons. And it turned out she wasn't wrong because her son did survive. Who knows? But she believed that. And so when she went on trial, I mean, she freely talked about what it was like to kill and dismember and boil down the fat of these women who had been her friends. It was really cold. She was as cold-blooded as really any serial killer you'll know, but she completely justified it for supernatural purposes.
Wow. Incredible.
So, yeah, she's not my favorite female, but she's among them because she's so unusual.
Absolutely. And what about the other case from Mexico? What about the witness report there?
Yeah, interesting, because that was a female, again, Juana Barraza, essentially. She has a long name that's in the book, but she was a female wrestler. So she's kind of big and strong. And there have been several witness reports after women have been killed in their homes. There have been several witness reports. One was that this killer was wearing a dress. But police there, and again, get into the whole stereotype thing, thought it had to be a man dressed as a woman, wearing a wig.
Sure.
And so that's what they were looking for. And finally, of course, they identified her as, I think she was actually, she killed someone and was seen by a person who was a boarder in the house. So he was able to call police quickly, and they got her, and then realized their error had been believing all this time they were looking for a man. In fact, she was a woman, but she was a female wrestler. So she, not a good one. She was pretty unsuccessful at it. You know, that court sort of TV sport kind of thing.
Right.
But she had a whole persona. You know, she had a wrestler name and the whole thing. And she was strong. She just had a resentment against these women. And so she killed them, and she would take things. She had a separating with another woman at first. They hired themselves out as maids to this cleaning service, and the two of them together were taking things. But then she turned into a killer on her own. So she's unusual.
Now, in your last part, part five, you have called self-surrender, and you have the co-ed killer and angel of death, but I thought that people might want to hear about the Candyman's apprentice, which is Elmer Wayne Henley. This is a fascinating story of two serial killers. Can you tell us about that?
Actually, three serial killers in that one, and one of them recently died. David Brook recently died in prison. I actually like that story best of those three. in part because I actually think Elmer Wayne Henley would not have turned himself in had he not been pressured to under the circumstances.
Right.
That's an interesting case of sex trafficking, where you had an adult predator, Dean Corll, who first drew in David Brooks, who was a teenager, to help him lure. And he was, in fact, a candy man because he made actual candy. His mother had a factory. He worked in the factory for a while. But also, he offered these kids drugs and alcohol. So he was that kind of candy man as well. But maybe these kids weren't going there because that's what they wanted. They were forced there. They were picked up in Coral's van and taken there because he wanted them for his sex parties. And he told David Brooks that he would pay him, you know, per kid, like $100 per kid or something like that. But in fact, he bought Brooks a car, et cetera. Brooks brought Elmer Wayne Henley, or some people say Wayne Elmer Henley, either way, Wayne Henley, as a potential victim. But Coral spotted in him, this could be another accomplice. Because he needed them not only to bring the kids in, but after he thoroughly tortured them on his torture board, a torture board, by the way, that was the inspiration for John Wayne Gacy. Gacy had read about the case and he thought, wow, that sounds great. That sounds very effective. They learned from each other, some of these killers. But anyway, so after the kids were thoroughly tortured and then finally murdered, Coral expected Henley and Brooks to take the bodies and bury them. So they had basically, that we know of, three basic sites. One was a piece of land that Coral owned, one was a beach, and one was a boatyard. And so they would just take and dump the bodies in these places. And then Henley got very involved in the murders too. He enjoyed it as well. But then one day, and these all were boys, and that's all Coral wanted. He said that he didn't want them to bring any girls. But one day, Henley brought a girl over because she wanted to run away from home. He liked her. He wasn't gay, but Coral was. But he liked this girl. He brought her over, and Coral was furious. So he put, you know, he got both of them, you know, wiped out on drugs and whatnot. They both passed out. He tied them up. And when they woke up, they realized that Coral was going to kill them both. And there was another kid there as well. So that was going to be three. Henley was able to persuade Coral that if you let me go, I'll help you kill them both if you let me go. So Coral did that. But he put his gun down in order to do that. And Henley realized he had the opportunity of a lifetime here because he didn't want Coral to kill his girlfriend. She wasn't actually his girlfriend, but she was a girl he liked. So he picked up the gun and he shot Coral. So Henley shot Coral, killed him. And then the three of them are there thinking, now what? Well, the two victims think we have to call the police. They're not aware that Henley has all this stuff to hide.
Yeah.
But, he either has to kill them or turn himself in. So I'm not so sure he would have turned himself in without that kind of situation, but he did. He turned himself in. He turned in Brooks, who wasn't very happy with him. And the two of them showed the police where the bodies were buried. There's one interesting photo. I think it's the only one of the two of them together where they're on the beach watching the diggers. And it's the two of them sitting together watching this. I think Henley was much more emotional over it. Brooks never gave an interview ever about this, but Henley did, numerous ones. He's still alive. I'm pretty sure. But Brooks is dead. So, and obviously Coral is dead. But that's an interesting case of three together. It's not the only time we've had that, but it's three together committing these murders, torture, horrible tortures of these young boys. And it's also a case of socioeconomic times in this area of Houston, because all these boys went missing from this area. And the cops basically said, they're just runaways. There was almost no investigation of, I think they've now up to 29, certainly 28. 27 were found at the time, but another's been identified since then. I think there might be another one for sure. How can you have that many people missing from a relatively, I guess, a couple of years period of time and not think something's going on? Well, it was the early 70s. We weren't even yet using the word serial killer for law enforcement. I mean, serial killer had been used in various textbooks and stuff, but not commonly used for law enforcement. It was, there were a few, Juan Corona in California, they dug up. In fact, that case, I believe Juan Corona had 25. And when they dug up the 27th body in the Houston murders, they said, that's enough. We've topped the Corona case in California. That's a horrifying statement to make.
Yeah.
In other words, you're saying, if there's any other victims, well, tough. we've done enough here. But we had the Juan Corona case with the mass graves in California. We had the Manson murders. There were a few others, but not many. So I guess they can be excused for not really understanding the phenomena of serial murder. But I still think, wow. Truman Capote had the chance to write about this case. And he passed it up because he thought Henley looked like a two-bit loser and he wouldn't be very interesting. But also Truman Capote at that time was so far gone in, his alcoholism and everything, he probably couldn't have written the book. But wow, this could have been, I think, another real expose of a certain American era. But it wasn't, it still could be. Somebody could do a great documentary of it. It's a great case.
Well, I think, people are seriously looking at it. I mean, in terms of maybe not specifically, but I mean, they will get to the cases that have all of that. Finally, Ted Bundy makes it to the big screen. I think it was a bit disappointing, but I think that Hollywood has recognized that there are some intrinsically fantastic stories here filled with all those things that make Hollywood movies what they are, but also just the cultural context that all of these things were able to happen and why.
I think they don't pay as much attention to the more marginalized victims, like gay serial murderer, sex workers. I will go out in Hollywood. They look for specific things. Ted Bundy had everything. So that's why he's constantly coming back, because he murdered beautiful young women, a lot of them. He was a good-looking law student. I mean, he has all the stuff that makes people watch. I don't think Dean Corll does. But I think it's still interesting story how the dynamic of this man who got these two teenagers to not just bring boys to him, but participate and torture. When you see his kit of torture instruments, oh my God, he beats Gacy by far.
It's there's not many cases where a young man is recruited for something like that. I know the I think it's Northcott case, Lowell Caulfield.
Yes.
And
there were a few in Europe, too, were they?
Pardon me?
There were a few in Europe, too, where that happens. But yeah, it is rare because, first of all, you're counting on your accomplice, who this isn't his thing. You're counting on that person to stay quiet. And oftentimes, that's the very person who ends up turning you in.
Yeah, absolutely. It's having to count on accomplices keeping their mouth shut. Criminals have been foolish thinking about that, counting on
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In this book, How to Catch a Killer, what do you summarize out of this entire project? What's the big summary I think you would gain from this, that you learned from this?
Well, I mean, the uplifting aspect, if there is one to be found, is how many are caught with, good, solid police work and forensic innovation. It isn't just some accidental, you arrested Randy Kraft for a speeding violation. He had a body in the passenger seat. are good stories, but that's not the majority of them. So I think the fact that good, solid police work, persistent officers who really think their way through these cases and really try to figure out, how to do this. Don't get caught in the stereotypes. Really put the pressure on to care about the victims and care about their families. That's the kind of good police work we've seen. So I think that's probably the main theme is when you look at how killers have been caught, it's often persistent, far-thinking, innovative detectives who care about what they're doing. And I like, those stories. I'm not sure what else. I think also the variety of things that killers have done, we have to keep in mind because I'm constantly hearing or seeing documentaries or scripted TV shows where it's the same thing over and over and over, and we fall into these ideas of what serial killers do and think we'll always know. And then someone like Israel Keyes comes along, or Stephen Port. I mean, that's a good case. What a clever thing he did. Also, that was a case of very poor police work. So I think that the lesson to be learned is that they can be caught. We need to understand them. We need to understand the variations, the deviations, and the fact that predators always look to their advantage and study us to figure out how to get around police procedures, accountability, beliefs that we have. The more our media plays into the stereotypes, the more advantages we give to killers. So I guess that would be a good thing.
Absolutely. It is also a profound examples in this book of what you called criminal intelligence. I want to thank you very much, Catherine Ramslin, for coming on and talking about your new book, How to Catch a Killer, Hunting and
You're
Capturing
welcome.
The World's Most Notorious Serial Killers. I want to thank you very much. I know
thank
that
you
for have
having
a
me.
Website.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
I don't use a website anymore.
Oh, okay.
I'm on Facebook. You can find me there probably more easily than anywhere else. Right now, I'm working on a show called Murder House Flip, and I just posted something on Facebook that if you have a murder house, we're looking to cast our second season. So you get an amazing renovation. But it's easy to find me on Facebook. I'm very active on it. I just let the website go.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you very much, Catherine. It's been absolute pleasure. Thank you, and have a great evening.
All right.
Good night.
You too. Bye.
Good night.